The McIlvaney Weekly Commentary, covering monetary, economic, and geopolitical news events.
How do you as an individual participate in real time and be a man or woman of your times? And yet also, with wisdom, live outside of your time and not subject to the tyranny and the dictates of whatever agenda is being pushed. How do you participate in your times and yet stand removed and objectively see what is happening?
Now here are Kevin Orrick and David McIlvaney.
Welcome to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. David, this is one of those days that I look forward to because when we go back and look in the rearview mirror at shows that we particularly liked or we felt had the theme of the year, when we go back and look at those and listen to those again, there's so much learning or relearning that can be had.
When I listen to something a second time, it seems I learn three times as much. And sometimes that's the same way it is with reading a book. You think that you got everything on the first read, and yet you chew it again and again, and you find there's so much more that can be gotten out of it. And so we look back with some frequency here in the office to either the interviews or even the conversations you and I have had and the topics discussed and remind them, so to say, go back through and find those nuggets and mull them over again, because we cover a lot of ground and sometimes it's easy just from week to week to actually forget some of the key things that have been discussed just here in the recent past.
Well, and I think the theme, as I listen back through Mark Faber and Tomasz Sedlacek, Ian McCavity, Jim Deeds, Bill King, the theme so far this year is that the central banking community has taught us false thinking. It's a false religion. Remember when Tomasz Sedlacek said somewhere, somebody came up with the idea that we have to have perpetual growth. Well, we've never seen that through human history. In fact, you know, God says to everything there's a season. There's a time to plant and there's a time to reap. You have growth cycles and you have shrink cycles. Yet the central banks, through almost a false religion, have taught people, oh, no, no, we have to have continued growth and we will provide that to you.
Right. So if someone presents a new reality and says, this is the way it's going to be from this point forward, we kind of go along to get along, don't ask any questions and say, well, surely someone with a PhD dictating and demanding that this is the way it's going to be heretofore. We're, again, just supposed to go along to get along. And I think what is sacrificed is something of our sanity, because we are taught to sort of, whether it's instinctively or logically or intuitively, figure things out. And retraining yourself to operate in a world where things don't make sense is dangerous.
Well, you know, I remember when you were asking Mark Faber what he would recommend to investors during this period of time of insanity. I love the thought that he says, well, you have to maintain your mental health.
Yeah, I think a part of maintaining mental health is going back through and saying, what does make sense? What does not make sense? And sticking to your guns in terms of what is logical and what is, frankly, nonsensical. It doesn't make sense to go along just to get along when the insane is being proposed. What else might you add to a list of investor virtues?
Well, basically, I think it touches on what you said. Some discipline and self-control. And in order to do that, I think you have to keep your mental health. And I think you have to keep also some common sense. I mean, if I look at the central bank's policies, in the long run, they really do not make any sense at all. And we are probably today in an unprecedented period of inflation, but it's hidden, this inflation, because consumer prices are not going up that much. They're going up more than what the Federal Reserve and the Bureau of Labor Statistics claim, because consumer prices would essentially need to be the cost of living. And as you know, the cost of living has gone up a lot everywhere. Insurance premiums, health care costs, food costs, rental costs, and so forth. But we had a huge asset inflation. I mean, I can't imagine any other period in history such as we had between 1980 and today, where asset prices have gone up to the same extent, and assets such as art, stocks, bonds, homes, everything is much more expensive than it was 20, 30 years ago. And that is overlooked frequently. And this huge Well, I have to rephrase this. Every inflation eventually comes to an end and ends up in deflation. So this colossal asset inflation one day will end up in a huge asset deflation. It may not imply that the whole world collapses economically. Because, say, we had in Japan after 1990 a colossal asset deflation. Stocks tumbled by more than 70%. Golf club memberships collapsed by 80%. And home prices went down substantially. Real estate went down a lot. But the standards of living of ordinary people actually went up because the cost of living went down and the wages were relatively stable. But it involved a very painful adjustment for Japanese asset holders. And we asset holders, we have been rewarded over the last 30 years or so. And I think the next period is a period during which we asset holders will be penalized. So it's not a very optimistic scenario if you have, say, $10 million and you think in 5 years' time you'll have 20 or 30, maybe you end up with half as many. But if you lose 50% and other people lose 80%, relatively speaking, you've done well.
So coming back to that diversified asset allocation, you think your best probability of walking through, that is not without harm, but less harm, is by having these baskets of real estate and stocks and precious metals and cash?
In theory, maybe the best would be to hold 100% cash. But what about if you're wrong and they print money like crazy and your cash loses as much purchasing power as it lost over the last 30 years? Say if you bought the house 30 years ago and today, then the house today is worth much more than 30 years ago. If you bought stocks 30 years ago, then you made a lot of money in stocks. If you held cash, you haven't made much money. So you didn't lose any, but relatively speaking to the assets, you lost out. And so if someone says, oh, I don't trust the system anymore, I have all in cash, to this I respond, yeah. So what kind of cash do you hold? Then he has to choose a currency. And how do you hold it? Oh, with the banks. What about if the banks go bust? You understand? So these are a lot of issues that the prudent investor has to consider. And the prudent investor, coming back to your question about what else should he do besides discipline and having some courage and so forth, I think it's important to understand that he may have a view about the future, but that view may be wrong. And there are many studies about forecasts, including mine. And in the long run, most forecasters have a horrible record, a horrible record. So we don't know how the world will look like in 5 years' time. In this scenario, I said to myself, well, I don't want to take huge risks.
So what you're describing as perhaps one of the necessary virtues for an investor is humility.
Yes. You see, when I started to work in the 70s stocks, the dividend yield on the Dow Jones was always around 5% and more. The 10-year treasury started 1970 at a yield of 6% and it went to over 15%. So yes, by buying bonds in the 70s, you lost money in the 70s, but you had a very high cash flow that was available for reinvestment. Please show me where do I have a big cash flow at the present time. You buy rental properties, the cash flow is very low, the cap rate. You buy government bonds, the 10 years, 2.15%, that's all you get. You buy stocks, most of them have hardly any dividends. So the cash flow is very low. And if you're wrong, you're going to lose a lot of money. Whereas in the 70s, A, stocks and bonds were cheap. But even if you were wrong for 10 years, you had a large cash flow.
What I like about Mark Faber is his view of history. In fact, every guest that we're going to listen to today, they have a unique view of history. It's personal view from their lifetimes, but it's also a studied view of history for thousands of years.
One of the things that I think he's getting at when he talks about the priority of cash flow is whether it's Berkshire Hathaway having access to proceeds from an insurance company or a retiree needing extra dollars from savings or a pension or insurance company, having to have a certain amount of income to make their outgoing cash needs possible. There's something happening here that is not being addressed. Central bank policy isn't matched up with my reality, your reality, the retiree's reality, the pension fund or insurance company manager's reality. And there are only a few people, maybe Berkshire's one of the only ones, that has this consistent and predictable cash flow. And granted, it's not from an investment per se, it's from a company that throws off a tremendous amount of cash flow. But that is absolutely critical to normal functioning. And if we adapt to what he said is sort of this nonsense, central bank policies that don't make sense at all, if we adapt to them, you know, what we're in essence doing is saying we're willing to change our behavior and our expectations to meet the insanity, which is to say even spending principal in the absence of income.
And this goes to the insanity of just coming up with perpetual growth. You know, when Tomasz Sedlacek said that the high priests of the new false religion are the central bankers, the false religion is perpetual growth. You really don't see that in nature at all, but we do see it in the nature of central banking.
Well, and we assume that what's happened over the last 30 years is normal and has always been the case. We've gone through a decline in interest rates for the last 30 years, which has accommodated a massive growth in credit, which has accommodated this apparently consistent and predictable growth in the economy, when quite frankly, it has everything to do with the cost of capital. If interest rates over the last 30 years had been on the increase, we wouldn't be talking about this nonsense about 2% predictable growth in the economy every year, because we'd probably have 1 or 2% declines in growth given the constriction of credit instead of its expansion.
Well, and I remember, you know, in economics class, we were taught that once a country gets into debt, you have to have perpetual growth. Now, see, Sedlacek is pointing this out. When you go too far into debt, you put yourself into a corner that's unnatural, and it ultimately ends badly.
That's point number one. And point number two, it's like I have this image of the economy being extremely naive field, because somewhere, I really don't know where, we took the idea, the belief, the ideology, the image that the economy grows or should grow 2% every year. That's like assuming that favorable winds will always blow. I mean, that's not a very good assumption. If I want to build a ship, I can't really build a ship under the assumption that favorable winds will blow all the time. That's not a very good ship. But unfortunately, that's exactly how we have constructed our economics. Our economics somewhere, I always ask my friend, where did you take it from? Is it written in the Bible? Is it anywhere in our models? Is it in the sky? Did you have a dream about it, that it's normal for the economy to grow like 2-3% every year? I mean, just because it's been doing so for the last, I don't know how many years, doesn't mean that it will always grow. And it never grew steadily. There were always, and even in the good periods of mankind, there were crises, there were slight decreases of GDP, and nobody was shooting themselves in the leg. So there, I think, is a huge sort of academic mistake. If we wanted to be very rigorous, and we should be rigorous, then where did this belief that the economy should grow by a certain percentage every year, where did it come from? That's a very naive belief. But unfortunately, we've built our pension system on it. We've built our government expense system on the assumption that the economies will always grow. Of course, the economy can stand still for a while. I mean, there's this huge image that the economy, if it doesn't grow, it collapses. But of course, the economy can stand still. What cannot stand still if the economy doesn't grow for a long time is all our social institutions that we've built upon it. So again, the point is, I have nothing against growth, like I have nothing against good weather. But, you know, expecting that every day will be a happy sunshine day is a recipe for a very depressed life.
Well, this gets to the issue of the social and political ramifications, because if we do move to a lower or slower growth model and it doesn't support our social obligations or pension system and what have you, then you do have sort of the revolt of the masses on your hand, unless you can convince them that austerity is good for all. So where do you stop catering to the masses and do what is economically wise in the long run?
Well, it's rather than to do with masses, it's the sort of mass ideology that we believe that every year we should grow. It's as
stupid as believing that every day should be a happy day or sunny day. This is, I think, generally true of our political life. This is true even of our personal life. We have this belief that things have to improve, otherwise they collapse. And this is simply not true. The majority of the history of mankind, we didn't even measure GDP. It wasn't anything that was actually important in human lives. And you can see this nicely in the following thought experiment. I always ask my audience when the issue comes to this, I always ask them, how many of you know whether your personal GDP, in other words, your income, whether it went up or down last year? That means last year, 2014 vis-a-vis 2015. Does any one of you know exactly by how much it went up? And by exactly, I mean, you know, to the decimal point of a percentage. And nobody ever has given me an answer. And people sometimes raise their hands and they say, well, you know, it went up by about 15%. And I say, I don't want your about. I want it exactly. You know, I can't tell to the media that GDP will go up about, you know, something between 2 to 10%. I need an exact figure. Nobody had an exact figure, and I doubt that any of the listeners will have an exact answer. Well, is it difficult to know how much your income went up by last year? No, you just call your accountant or you check your tax returns and, you know, you divide the two numbers one by another and you see exactly by how much your income went up. But nobody knows. Now, do we not know because it's methodologically difficult to know? No, it's easy. You just call your accountant, 2 minutes conversation. We don't know because we don't care. So on a personal level, we don't really exactly care whether our income went up or down because we don't do these graphs. We don't have graphs for our personal income in our shelves back home, you know. We don't do this, even though our personal GDP, our income, is much more important to our lives than some abstract GDP of all United States of America, which is almost no relevance to how much you will earn or lose in your day job. So my question is, what sort of ideological math magic happens when I don't care for my income when it's on my personal level, but then when it suddenly becomes an income of a country, I'm almost ready to dismantle the European Union just because in some region there, this number is not providing me with the result that I was sort of naively expecting. So if we stop being naive and if we actually will be able to think in terms of, okay, sometimes it goes up, sometimes it goes down, just like Job in the Old Testament says, can we only expect good things from the Lord? You know, we also have to, you know, receive bad things from the Lord. So, okay, today it isn't really the prayer, isn't the Lord, it's rather the market. So we have to be able to receive good things from the market as well as bad things from the market. I mean, the market isn't just good. The market is like everything else we've created, bipolar. Car can be a good thing, it can be a deadly thing. I mean, cell phones are wonderful, but they also collapse, they freeze, they don't function all the time properly. And the same thing with economics. Economics is not divine. There is no God of economics. There is no regulation in it. It's just our left hands and our right hands. And it's about time that we stop believing in this mysterious force that is directing the whole world forward.
Well, you know, it still goes to cycles, Dave, and you have to let the day be day and the night be night. Now, we've looked at globalization through the years, and globalization usually is a synonym for peace in the world.
And prosperity.
Exactly. When you've got markets that are flowing, and that means ebbs and tides, okay, both sides, globalization seems to work quite well, like, you know, a little over 100 years ago. But when they don't let the markets correct, and when you don't let it ever be night, I'll give you an example. We had a chicken coop, and to keep them warm in the evenings or at night, we left a light on. Well, the problem was their cycle, it ultimately aged them much quicker than they should have aged because they really never slept. Animals needed to be dark sometimes to sleep as well. In a market, it's the same type of thing. And the problem is globalization can flourish during a time of central bank intervention, but if they don't let it correct at some points, you have a crisis that destroys globalization.
I know we didn't play the particular clip from the Sedlacek interview where we talked about Jubilee and sort of a forced end to debt, which is something that is addressed in the Old Testament where every 50 years there is a debt jubilee. But I think there's a recognition in that that there would always be the desire for men to maintain this perpetual income stream on the backs of the debtor. And so this credit relationship built into Old Testament law was this, no, it has to end and restart. Even if you're not willing to automatically, it will by law. And it's interesting because it needs to happen Ordinarily, it does happen, but there's also this issue of human nature wanting more and not necessarily allowing nature to go its natural course. And, you know, certainly we have that in 08 and 09 where we see central bank manipulation and holding things together where ordinarily you would have seen a much more significant correction. Now, for those who experienced 08 and 09 and think, well, it was significant, just understand that valuation levels only got to about half of what they should have been at a normal market low, looking back at the periods of 1932, 1937, 38, 1949,
what you're saying
1982.
Is there's more pain to come because we put a Band-Aid on it too soon.
It should have been, and that raises the question, is there still more to come?
Globalization was a wonderful thing for a while, and it basically kept on going and accomplished a lot on a global basis. But once it gets into a period of turbulence, that turbulence, it's, you know, it's like a nasty hangover. You can't wish a hangover away. You got to go through the process. And the problem is, back in 2008, 2009, they didn't really let the markets clear. A lot of that mortgage debt should have just gone up in smoke. It shouldn't have been bought by banks and sustained and maintained. And they were just in reluctance to sort of let a market clear out. You know, it's in a sense kicked the can down the road and causing the bigger problem when it does surface. As things slow down, we're going to see them try to kick the can further down the road. I don't know what rule changes they're going to come up with this time, but for sure they'll try.
And this brings us back to, you know, sort of Act Two in the play we know as Global Recession / Depression. You know, when you look back at the charts, you see some interesting relationships from 1966 to 1982. That was a pretty rough period for stocks, and it was a great period of time for gold. So if you're looking at the Dow gold ratio, that was a period of outperformance for the metal. You increased your purchasing power pretty considerably. There was a 2-year period in there that was very rough for the gold owner and great for stocks. I'm wondering if we've just kind of lived through an extended version of 1974 to 1976, where it was no joy in Mudville for the gold owner those couple of years, and the stock investor looked like a genius temporarily.
Well, think back to what was happening. You know, when the gold price was liberated in 1968 to 71 at $35 an ounce, the first run basically took it up to $200 an ounce, or $199 on January 1, 75. That was the day that Americans were allowed to buy gold, you know, that was non-numismatic. That was when the right to own gold was restored in the U.S. And because I was operating in Canada, and we were all waiting. We were all waiting for the American buyers to come storming in on January 2nd of 1975, but somebody forgot to give them the phone number because the gold price topped out just prior to that and then proceeded to go from 200 right back down to 103 in mid-76. In many respects, that was a very strong period for the equity market and a very poor period for gold. That's really what that corrective period was. And I agree with your analogy of that 74-76 correction in that great run in the Dow gold ratio. And I think that that's what we've been in since 2011. It's been much more extended, and it's been extended in many respects because of QE3 and all of the extraordinary measures that Bernanke threw into the system. But at the same time, to me, when you look at it, the ratio basically retraced about one half of what had moved, and it seems to be stalling around the same levels that it was in back in 2006. And in a sense, on the run-up, 2006 was a fairly material breakout point. So we ran into resistance. We haven't turned the ratio yet, but I think that we are still headed sometime in the next few years. The way I refer to it is, you know, with 2020 vision from 2020, I think we will have seen a crisis that will have taken the gold ratio back to something like a 2-to-1 ratio.
Well, so those are the kinds of extremes that you would ordinarily associate with a crisis. We got as low as a 6-to-1 ratio in the global financial crisis circa 2008 and 2009. And then that number has reversed course, again, similarly to the way the Dow gold ratio reversed course in 74 to 76.
Bear in mind the other extreme on that. It was when gold was flattened its back in 1999-2000. You could take one unit of the Dow and get 45 ounces of gold for it. Yeah, that was really the beginning of the modern gold cycle. And to me, that's the cycle that we had this tremendous run-up.
that we're still in the corrective mode, and I think that we are still, in the next few years, headed back down to that 2-to-1 ratio. And that would be the other extreme.
So gazing into the future, your 2020 vision sees sometime between 2020 and 2025 on the calendar, something like a Dow Gold 2-to-1, maybe even 1-to-1.
Yep, exactly. Well, we've been below 2-to-1 three times, 1896, 1932, 1980. And is anyone going to try and tell me that the financial mess that we've got today is less than any of those prior crises? I just don't see that this isn't the greatest financial crisis in the history of mankind, you know, when it starts being unglued.
And just as a reminder, Ian McCavity has been in this business now for 50 years. You know, it reminds me of the guest that we had, Jim Deeds, who both of them are saying the same thing right now. They're like, you know, the ratios, the Dow gold ratio, the rise in gold. Both of these men were there the last time we saw the great bottom and the great top of the gold bull market. And they're saying, here it is again.
Well, and what Deeds would say is the price of gold is going considerably higher. What McCavity said was that what is essentially happening is a contraction in values across the world, and your purchasing power in gold terms increases significantly. Now, does that sound like two different messages? It's actually the very same message, because as the price of gold increases, all it's doing is bettering your purchasing power.
It buys more stuff.
To go from today's 13 or 14 to 1 Dow gold ratio to a 2-to-1 or even a 1-to-1 ratio, you're increasing your financial footprint by 7 times. Now, that's intriguing because, again, we tend to look at the capital gain. If gold goes up, that's good. But actually, it's just the expansion of your footprint that's the imperative. Whether that is in capital gains terms or just in relative terms, I think these men are saying the same thing, just with a different language or motif. Now, things were changing in the 1960s, you know, not only a lot of sort of political chaos globally as we got to 1966, 67, 68, but also a pretty interesting revolt monetarily from the dollar standard and what we knew as the Bretton Woods system. And of course, during those years, there was a massive amount of gold leaving the United States. The French were responsible for a good part of that being pulled. And so change was occurring. And here you are taking some interest in gold, which wasn't even legal here in the United States for another 7 years.
This is really amazing. And I'm looking at the book right now because I wanted to mention that to you. In 1968, and I don't know why I got this book. I think I probably know why. I probably was interested. But I got a book named The Death of the Dollar. There's probably been 100 of those books written since that time. But this was written by William F. Rickenbacker. He worked for Bill Buckley. And he was an editorial writer at National Review for Bill Buckley. And he wrote this book. And it was an amazing book. I'm looking at a paperback, but it was only about half inch thick. But he laid down all the reasons why, within the next few years, we were going to be in a lot of trouble, and why you had to therefore own gold. He was a gold bug back then. And, you know, his book came out. If you said, why would you look at that? I've been thinking about it. At that time, I was at Dean Witter downtown, and I would go out to buy some gum or a candy bar or whatever, and I would always get my change. And in 68, it was the time, this was right after Conley came out and said, at a question at a conference one day, he said, I will never remove silver from the United States money. And then, believe it or not, 6 months later, the clad coins came out and the silver coins were disappearing. And believe it or not, David, reading that book and seeing silver coins disappear and keeping all my silver coins whenever I got one and change, from that point on, I just thought gold and silver were the best money. I believed that since then all my life. I mean, I should say the money of last resort, perhaps, or whatever you want to call it.
Yeah, money of last resort. It's certainly not preferred by the establishment. It brings certain disciplines that don't fit with the easy money trends that we've seen of recent decades. Well, when you began to see those changes, what did you advise to your clients?
This was neat, and it was really exciting, because I did, you know, right or wrong, was thinking for myself. So I started to look, and I looked at the gold mines, and at that point in time, in 68 and 69, Dome Mines and Campbell Red Lake Mines were the leading gold producers up in Canada, and so I started to buy them. I'm a position broker, and I started buying these for all my clients at Dean Witter. And I got a pretty good start on that, and then the Chicago office at Dean Witter called one day and said, why is this guy in Denver buying gold stocks? Nobody else in the country is doing that. Why is he doing that? And the only answer would have been, I had read the book, The Death of the Dollar, and I thought, since gold had been out of favor and no one had looked at a gold stock, to my mind, for years, that they might offer some value. And it worked out well.
So they offer some value, and you see that, just like Brunswick looked like good value to you when you were in college.
Oh, and you see bowling alleys going up all over the state of Colorado, you say, golly, the guy that sells pin setters might make some money. Right.
So it's an interesting psychological profile to be able to do something before anyone else is.
Yeah.
You know, and without sort of the affirmation or approbation of your peers. And in fact, you're talking about compliance, who's watching the trades go through, and they're asking questions. What is this? What's going on?
That's right.
A similar experience, Jim, 2000, 2001, 2002, I was working for Dean Witter. Of course, it had become Morgan Stanley Dean Witter. And I had the same calls from compliance. What are you doing buying gold shares? Why are you doing this? And of course, I wasn't reading Rickenbacker's book. I was reading whether it's Don's newsletter or a whole host of other things. It's kind of in my blood.
You were brought up in that atmosphere for sure. See, I think that's the interesting point which I would make is that way back then, there were people who looked at what was going on and said, this doesn't add up. And I do see that if things don't work out right, gold and silver, they're only an answer because they're limited supply, they're valued highly around the world, and they've worked for 5,000 years when we have a stress in a financial system. Some people, not all, will return to gold and silver thinking it's the safest place to be. That's easy. I think we know that from history, don't we?
We do. But it was the same folks in Chicago who, I'm guessing, were very enthusiastic at some point in that cycle and wondering why you were selling those same gold shares that you had been buying early on in the cycle.
I can't remember how it happened, but I don't remember pain in 1973 and 74, except in the market in general, which was just awful. And so it was a very difficult time because a lot of clients in those days, stockbrokers had 50 to 100 clients, and you talked to them every other week or so on, and they were good friends, and you had something going in common with all those people. And in 1974, it all fell apart. Truthfully, the market went down to such a degree. And the gold stocks, I wasn't in it at that time. I went to South Africa in 74 because I was still very interested in gold and went on a conference over there. And I remember Val Reese was trading at 28, was the biggest gold mine in the world at that point. And in 74, it fell as low as 7. I started buying it at 10 and watched it go down to 7. But then 4 years later, it was up to $140 a share. And I had sold all mine out. I was following my pattern. I would hold it for about 2 or 3 years, and I sold all of our clients and mine out at $28 a share and thought I was really doing very well. $10 to 28 was a pretty neat deal in a couple of years.
It was.
And as a stockbroker, I guess you knew that was about how it worked, right?
Well, and 140 would have been nice for at least a few shares, but no, you can't cry over that spilled milk.
In retrospect, I would like to have held it all the way to 140. But I went from Val Reese to other gold mining. I went to Eland's Rand, I went to Durban Deep, you know, and the smaller and younger South African golds. I worked with Peter Miller, who was the best analyst in South Africa, and he had great ideas. And his plan was simple, David, which doesn't fit today, but it's interesting. Back then, South Africa was English and Afrikaners, Dutch, and they invested for dividends. So Peter would come out every quarter and update his ideas on what the dividends would be from these gold stocks as the price of gold went up. And he would guess which ones would raise their dividends the most, and those were the gold shares we would own. And sure enough, they would go up the most. So isn't that strange in relation to what we see today?
Well, dividends are not quite as popular.
No. I don't know many gold shares that are paying much of a dividend, do you?
2 or 3%, which is better than nothing. And it's actually, for some of those miners, even with a decline in the gold price, they've continued to pay a dividend. They are making some money. And it's a dividend that's comparable to what the S&P is paying. So you've got one pocket that is undervalued and paying out something. And the other extreme, the S&P 500, let's say, and NASDAQ, which is paying out a pittance but is overvalued, where would you want to be?
Oh, that's right. And see, I woke up a week ago today with an answer for me as to what all of a sudden at about 4 a.m. made a lot of sense. But what you just asked is the million-dollar question, and that is, in today's world, it really is difficult to find value or to find something with a perceived ability to retain its value over the next 2 or 3 or 5 years. Because most of the assets at that time are either overpriced or have no return whatsoever. They have a higher degree of risk, it would seem.
So one of the things Jim points out is that it pays to see things that other people don't see. And that suggests that you are thinking for yourself. It suggests that you are maybe reading for yourself and assessing the world independent from the Wall Street jargon, the Washington agenda, and sort of the mass media hype. Because if you look at those three, you're really talking about an unholy trinity that is dealing with perception management, that wants you to come to certain conclusions about the way the world is. And they need to affect, number one, your belief, and then number two, your behavior. And so it's not odd that a gold bull market is overlooked and underappreciated by Wall Street, Washington, and the mass media, because they're after a different set of behaviors from you, driven by a certain number of beliefs which they have inculcated in you. And again, that ties very neatly into sort of central bank command and control dynamics. We will create perpetual growth. We will not allow a business cycle downturn. We will manage this whole process. And I think the Fed knows that the game is up. But again, what are they playing for? That's what Bill King gets into in this next clip. They're dealing still with perception management because they must.
The new mantra is with the central banks. You know, for decades, is we can always save the world, and we're going to show you. Now it's like, you know, all these measures are just temporary. You guys got to restructure. You know, this is on the governments now. We can't keep doing this. So there is that admission. But on the other hand, you know, they're the captain of the Titanic. You know, what's his name? John Smith. And the boat's going down, and he knows it. And what's he going to do? You know, he can't run around and create panic and say, you know, you're all going to die, or most of you are going to die, or whatever. He just has to keep the stiff upper lip and try to keep people calm. And, you know, hopefully somebody comes in, the Carpathian, whoever comes and picks up the survivors. And I think that's what's starting to happen in here. They've played this game for 7 years now, and it's making matters worse. Just what you said is you're taking money from the masses, putting it in a few hands, and then the people that have the access and have the ability to leverage that money are winners. And that's why you've had this concentration of wealth. The people that control large amounts of assets have won, and you've taken all this interest income away from literally billions of people around the globe and put it in a few hands. And you're right. Part of the low interest game is to help the people that are in debt, which are mostly sovereigns. I mean, can you imagine if you had the normal 5 or 6% interest rates now in the U.S. on that debt? I mean, you'd be talking, you know, in excess of $1.2 trillion in interest payments per year. That's astounding. And that's part of the game. There's no question that's part that the central banks are trying to facilitate the government debt here. I mean, that's what Trump has talked about, how, you know, Fed has been bailing out Obama and creating this bubble and, you know, bailing out Congress so nobody has to make any decisions here. You just let this game go. See, that's the thing now, is what the game has become for the Fed and for the sovereigns. Who's going to take the hit when it blows up? Who's going to take the blame? And that's where you can see Draghi and the other central bankers who are trying to move away. You know, they're starting to say, hey, where they were rock stars and look at, well, aren't we great guys and we saved the world? Now they're like, you know, we can only do this temporarily. It's on the governments to do what they need to do.
It raises the question, who is going to take the hit? Who is going to take the blame? Who is at greatest risk? I mean, you've got the establishment that's in the crosshairs.
Well, that's it right there. They're going to take it. And the establishment is an encompassing term. And it means all the levers of power, the ruling class, which the Fed has become joined at the hip with big government and the big banks. That's the game. And it's been historic. You know, if you look back throughout history, it's always been the ruling class. And when they go on these spending sprees, you know, all the way back to the 17th century, you know, and especially in the 18th century, with all the wars and whatever, when you want to do the government spending, whether it's for the war, for the guns or the butter or both, you got to have somebody to finance it. So it was always, you know, the financiers and the bankers and the sovereigns all tied together. And when you had the blow up, whether it was the French Revolution or just some of the other problems throughout the centuries there, that's the establishment. And it's not just government, but it also is the bankers and financiers and that. So in the past, it really fell on the ruling class. But I think now in the age of, you know, internet, whatever, I think you see, and the Fed has brought it on themselves. I remember, you know, 30, 40 years ago, people didn't know. Very few people even knew who the chairman of the Fed was, let alone the president or the vice chair. Now these idiots are out almost daily speaking and running their mouths. They just should shut up and go away. That tells you how much they're trying to influence the markets because they're out there daily. But you can't do that. It's like listening to sports radio every day. I mean, it's just nonsense. You get an element of wisdom here and there, but the amount of noise in Jabberwocky is just overwhelming. And this didn't happen before. But it just, again, it shows you how desperate these people are. And also the ego side. This is all in Greenspan. My gosh, I can't remember how many times Volcker talked during the 80s there. But then all of a sudden, people were slobbering all over Greenspan because, you know, he's creating all this credit and you ran these bubbles. And he got full of himself, and now all these other guys are all full of themselves out there running around talking. And it's not good. It's not good for anybody.
What Bill King points out is just so important, and that is that hubris, you know, the pride, comes before the fall. And you were talking about perception management. Once you see the reliance on perception management, negative interest rates, those types of things, you realize that the pride that they had in controlling the economy is now starting to come apart.
Well, so the issue is that all of these things are cyclical, whether it is human confidence or the error of optimism. I mean, there's the error of pessimism and the error of optimism. And it represents sort of the two polar opposites. You go from one extreme to the next, and you're really in a dangerous place when you're tempted by either one. And you see this where, again, the error of optimism amongst Greenspan, as Bill King likes to say, and now all the other central bankers who followed suit, they're so full of themselves, they do believe that they're masters of the universe, that they can do anything that they want. And the market somehow follows them like mice following the Pied Piper. And yet that doesn't square with history. It doesn't square with financial or market history at all. And I think it's interesting how when we get to these extremes, there are these representations of the extreme. And if we notice them, if we paid attention to them, it'd be very, very helpful as investors. I think of Carl Icahn making Time magazine in January of 2014. That was basically the peak of Icahn Enterprises. And he was billed as a master of the universe. That's what it read on the front of Time magazine in January 2014.
Yet when you see the graph, you see that that was the very peak of his valuation.
His shares are down 62%. But so he was a master of the universe in January of 2014. What is he now? Down 62% in terms of the value of his assets. This is indicative of, again, sort of perception management. It was obvious. He was at the top of his game, right? No, actually, usually when people are at the top of their game, that's it. That's it. And when people believe that this is it, there's nothing left on the downside, we're at rock bottom. What it reminds me of, and this is why it's so important to learn some market history, when people are assuming one thing universally, you can generally bet the exact opposite and be fine. Yet 1932, everyone was throwing in the towel. There was no reason to stay invested in stocks. How do you think stock values got down to an 89% discount off of their peaks? Was it a good time to buy? Actually, it was a good time to buy. And yet that was one of the first periods known as the quote-unquote death of equities.
What's interesting is you could have purchased the Dow with 2 ounces of gold at that time. The Dow ended up rising all the way to 30-1 before it had topped out.
That's right. And through multiple cycles, the same kind of thing, again, going from investors subject to the error of optimism on the one hand, uber bullishness that knows no bounds, to the air of pessimism, willing to throw in the towel and not be rational about what represents good value, you see that Dow gold ratio continuing to bounce back and forth from one extreme to the other. The last extreme, as McCavity noted, 45-1, circa 2000-2001. We've dropped to 6-1.
And he's looking for 2-1.
He's looking for 2-1.
So for the person who's listened to the wise insight of these five guys who we've talked to over the last year, what would you say would be the concluding wrap-up? What is the to-do for the person who just listened to the program?
I think one of the things that I hear from all of them is that what you see is not always what you see. I mean, when you are looking, whether it's at Bloomberg or CNBC or the front of the Wall Street Journal or the USA Today, there is a message that's being given to you, and it's a very specific message, and it is designed to create a certain behavior and action on your part. And it's not necessarily a behavior or action that's going to be good for you. It's good for the system.
And if it doesn't make sense?
You really should not do it. And so that's the question is, can you stand back? How do you as an individual participate in real time and be a man or woman of your times? And yet also, with wisdom, live outside of your time and not subject to the tyranny and the dictates of whatever agenda is being pushed, whether it's a Wall Street agenda or a Washington, D.C. agenda, how do you participate in your times and yet stand removed and objectively see what is happening? My suggestion is that you spend time with people who have more of a grasp of history than you do. And that's why these are the kinds of people that we have on the commentary. My suggestion is that beyond individuals and personalities, that you take a deeper look and study history yourself. My suggestion is that you take time to pause and not be constrained by the tyranny of the urgent, where you feel it necessary to take action every second of every day, but slow down. Really good quality decisions, you only have about one quality decision to make every 3 to 5 years. And in that time frame, lots of things are happening that are supposedly very, very important. Notice every 2 to 4 years, we have the same sort of political kabuki theater where all of us get sucked into thinking that these are the most pressing issues of our day. And yet, once we get past the election cycle, what do we have? We go back to normal. We go back to normal, and all of a sudden, the theater kind of fades away. If you can avoid being sucked into the emotionalism, make quality decisions informed on reason, logic, history, I think you're putting yourself in a very good position over the next several years.
So what I think you're saying, Dave, is what Paul said in the Bible, run the race with patience and don't overreact to things that seem to be perception management driven rather than rock solid decisions.
Yeah, it seems to me that to some degree we've been trained to react to all things around us as adolescents would, sort of exaggerating and feeling more emotional about a particular issue than we should or need to. And, you know, a cool as a cucumber parent might come alongside an adolescent and say, just calm down. It's going to be okay. It's going to be okay. What you're feeling right now, yes, that may be real to you, but it doesn't actually reflect reality. Maybe you can't even get away with saying that, but as a parent, you know it to be true and you just encourage calm. And I think that's what we need in the months and years ahead. Cool, calm, collected, wise decision making, informed decision making, and the results of that, I think, will be profoundly beneficial to your family.
You've been listening to the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. I'm Kevin Orrick along with David McIlvaney. You can find us at McIlvaney.com, McIlvaney.com, or give us a call at 800-525-9556.
This has been the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary. The views expressed should not be considered to be a solicitation or a recommendation for your investment portfolio. You should consult a professional financial advisor to assess your suitability for risk and investment. Join us again next week for a new edition of the McIlvaney Weekly Commentary.